Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and my voice is not entirely here. So if I cough or lose it occasionally, please bear with us. Each year, over 3,000 Alaskans will be told they have cancer. Managing the physical and emotional symptoms of a cancer diagnosis can be challenging for patients and their families. Palliative care is a team-based approach that improves quality of life by addressing these symptoms and treating the whole person, not just the cancer. To help us understand palliative care for cancer in Alaska, we have Emily Neenan here. She is a government relations director for the American Cancer Society of Alaska. And Pat Dooley, she is director of the hospice program at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Pat wants me to make sure everybody knows she is not here speaking for the palliative care operations at Providence, but she has lots of experience in palliative care, pain management, and so forth. She's just their hospice program director. So welcome to both of you to Line One.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
One more thing I almost always forget. So listeners, if you have questions today during the next hour, and I'll give you this number and contact information intermittently, if you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of us. If you call us directly, it's 550-8433. 550-8433. Toll free 1-888-353-5752. And we also will be available by email over the next hour at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. Emily, let's start by just learning a little bit about the American Cancer Society, if you don't mind telling us who they are, what they do, their mission, and so forth.
Sure. Happy to. Thank you once again for having us here today to talk about this issue. So the American Cancer Society has been around for the last 100 years and has evolved over that time. There are a few key areas that the organization focuses on now. One of the big things that we always talk about is research. The American Cancer Society is the second largest funder of cancer research in the nation, second only to the U.S. federal government. The other areas that the Cancer Society focuses on are things like patient services. So we have volunteer programs that we organize here in Alaska, as well as partnerships with businesses to help patients get to treatment. Travel is often a concern, so we being able to cover travel costs. We have some great partnerships with Raven Airlines and Penn Air to help folks get into wherever they need to be for treatment. Also work with making sure they have a place to stay when they get there. So we have partnerships with a number of hotels in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau to help folks out when they're going through treatment. So those are a couple key areas. We also have a tremendous amount of resources. So if you're looking for information on anything, you know, hitting cancer.org is a good, safe starting website. The internet can be a scary place, but cancer.org is a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm constantly amazed. As we've moved on as a civilization, one of the things that's enabled that is the ability to get information easily and rapidly. And we have more than ever before. The problem is being able to tell what's good and reliable. And certainly the Cancer Society's website. And by the way, if you're listening, we have links to both the palliative care organization at Prov and Cancer Society on our webpage as well. So it's a good place to start if you've got questions, any kind of questions about cancer, it seems to me.
Yes, thank you.
Where do you get your money? How does the Cancer Society provide its programs?
So we have community fundraising events all over the nation. Our largest fundraiser, actually the largest nonprofit fundraiser in the country, is the Relay for Life. And there are a number of those held every year around the state of Alaska. We also have some other events called Making Strides Against Breast Cancer. Those are some walks in Anchorage and Fairbanks. Most of the funding for the American Cancer Society does come from those individual donors donating small amounts of money at a time. So it's a lot of work to piece it all together, but we really try to maximize those resources.
And the Cancer Action Network is often closely associated when you start looking online. What's that all about?
Sure. So the American Cancer Society has an advocacy affiliate called the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We usually just use the abbreviation ACS-CAN. So if you hear me talking about that, that's what I'm saying. That's the advocacy affiliate. We are, and that's who I represent and have worked for a number of years now. We work on public policy issues. So when I mentioned that the American Cancer Society is the largest funder of cancer research, second only to the federal government, when that's where ACS-CAN comes into play, making sure that the federal government keeps investing and increases investments to get federal cancer research funding.
And are you active then nationally as well as locally and in the state trying to promote quality asthma cancer care?
Absolutely. We work on the federal, state, and local level. So on the federal level, a lot of work on research appropriations and that process. We have a whole federal team that works on that. I work with a number of partner agencies and volunteers here in the state of Alaska. Things like protecting people from secondhand smoke in the workplace, making sure people have access to preventive screenings for cancer, things like that at the local and state level here in Alaska. And improving patient quality of life is one of the areas that we're really delving into.
And that takes some legislative efforts as well then.
Yes. So it turns out a lot of the decisions, the most important decisions about somebody's cancer care are not only made in their doctor's offices. Those decisions are made in the halls of Congress, in our state legislature, and even at our local city council levels. When it comes to palliative care, we're really working to increase research in the area because there's so much promise for this whole field, and also to increase training for medical professionals around the country.
I want to get Pat in and talk about palliative care, but I also suddenly in my mind, I'm always thinking about the listener and putting things in perspective, and I'm going to make an observation from my point of view, and I need for you to correct me if I'm wrong, but I hope that I'm right, and I hope everybody listening is now aware that there have been tremendous strides in not only the treatment of cancer, the longevity after diagnosis, but also that cancer rates in many of the cancers are decreasing now, which is it's not a perfect story by any means, but there's a lot to be optimistic about.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up. It's something that I get, having worked for the Cancer Society for the last 14 years, something I get questioned on quite right. frequently. It's exciting to be in this field and to see the advances that are happening. When I talk with my volunteers, they can tell stories of, I've got a volunteer in Kenai, for instance, who was diagnosed with breast cancer about 10 years after her mother was. Her treatment was only about half as long as her mom's treatment had been. So when you think about what's the impact on somebody's life, it's a lot less of the side effects that you're dealing with when you're going through treatment, and then a lot less disruption in your life. So huge, huge advances. And in the 10 years it's been since her treatment, she had another friend with a very similar diagnosis. Her treatment was cut even shorter because of advances in research.
Mm-hmm. And the success of treatment, not perfect by any means, but is improving.
Absolutely. There are a lot of success stories along the way. And that said, one of the reasons that we're trying to elevate this conversation, get more people talking about patient quality of life, is there's more to it than just sort of what your people talk about, the 5-year survival rate. There's more to it than just being a number and somebody's statistic. Everybody's individual experience with cancer or any other serious illness is really personal to their own body and their life and their circumstances.
All right. So, Pat, let me get you into this conversation and tell us about palliative care. What do we mean? Can you distinguish it as well from hospice care, which might be confusing to listeners as well?
Sure. Hospice has been around for a while, and Medicare-certified hospices have been around in the United States since the 80s, and we don't have a lot of them in Alaska. We've got four Medicare-certified hospices actually in Alaska right now, and hopefully a fifth one is coming up in Anchorage soon. Frontier Home Health is hopefully theirs is opening soon. And we have some volunteer hospices out in smaller communities. And actually, Anchorage has a Hospice of Anchorage, which is a volunteer hospice. So they don't charge for their services, but they basically provide, psychological support, social service support, spiritual support. And palliative care is hospice is actually a kind of palliative care, but really palliative care should start as soon as somebody has a diagnosis of a serious illness that might conceivably cause their death. So, we're always thrilled when we can graduate people from hospice because they really don't need us anymore. And many, many people find that cancers become almost like a chronic disease or they're cancer-free. But in the meantime, when you're going through treatment and you've got that diagnosis or you have any other kind of serious illness and you're trying to make those decisions, what palliative care can do is it can help you. It helps walk you through the decisions, talk about what your options are, really help you decide what your real goals of care are. The first thing that a palliative care person will ask you is, what do you know about your disease? What would you like to know? And what are your goals of care and how can we help you meet them? So that could be pain and symptom management. It might be transportation. It might be working on your advanced directives. It can be a number of things. So palliative care walks along with you while you're getting treatment or if you decide you don't want any more treatment. It can even be if you're cancer-free and just checking in periodically and hopefully getting a clean bill of health that way. So it's a continuum, and hospice is really it's a more intensive kind of palliative care at the end of life.
All right, so the big overriding idea here is here's palliative care on the top, and one of the options underneath the palliative care spectrum of cares or offerings would be hospice care.
Right. When you get to a point where either the medical profession feels like there's nothing else they can offer or you've decided that you really don't want any more treatment and it appears that that without more treatment that, your life expectancy is much shorter than it has been, so you're approaching the end of your life, the goal shifts from a cure or hoping for a cure to comfort. So most people want to be comfortable, safe, comfortable, in their own homes, pain-free, symptom-free, able to spend time with their families. And that's where hospice can be very helpful.
So one of the thoughts I guess I have in my mind is it's not, I guess, because we're talking about cancer, I want to make sure people hear what you've already said just briefly. It's not just for cancer patients. We're talking about a patient with ALS, perhaps, a very nasty neurologic disease, or maybe even multiple sclerosis, or maybe even severe crippling kinds of arthritis, for example.
Yes, it could be. It could be lung disease, heart disease, liver disease, lots of different kinds of dementias or neurological issues. Sometimes the medical profession, they're not exactly sure what's going on. And it could be just not one thing. It could be a couple of things. So especially as we get older and those diseases start piling on top of each other, there may be one thing that if you didn't have all those other conditions, you could live with it. But now you've got, heart disease and lung disease, and now your kidneys aren't working. So you're at a point where, hospice makes sense.
How would you answer the question? I guess I'm trying to always get listeners to be thinking critically about things and making the right decisions. How would you answer the question, how do we know that palliative care is helpful? What is it that we know, what evidence do we have that it's beneficial versus standard care?
That's hard to answer because, really, in my opinion, palliative care should be the standard of care.
Right.
So on top of all of the medical and nursing and social services and PT and OT and whatever else you're getting, palliative care should be walking along beside it. And it really is about quality of care. Mm-hmm. There's been research showing that people, and I can only speak for hospice, people who, especially at the end of their life, if they have a cancer, is they actually do live a little bit longer, but the quality of life is higher.
Yeah.
So the report back is that that what time you had left was quality time.
And I'll just jump in here and add, when we're working on increasing funding for palliative care education and research, we have to demonstrate that there's a reason for this. And it's really interesting because we've found you would expect that patients feel better. If you're doing things to manage different symptoms they may have and improve their quality of life, that's the whole goal, of course the patient's going to feel better. But we found a couple other things. One is that outcomes are actually improved. So it turns out you can reduce emergency room visits by that same patient and end up with lower costs. And the exciting thing, and Pat sort of made a reference to this earlier when she talked about people graduating from hospice care, which is normally end-of-life care, is that palliative care can even improve outcomes, improve how somebody's able to fight the disease process that's going on in their body just by managing all the other stresses and symptoms that are going on.
Yeah, I think in the research for this, I remember briefly seeing a New England Journal of Medicine, one of our premier journals, looking at that. And one of the outcomes was it did seem that not only quality of life, but length of life after diagnosis was extended. So.
And just to jump in, we find that in hospice, and we've also seen that in palliative care, whereas if you can get people's pain under control or you can help them with their sleep or their appetite, often people can, some healing can take place physically. So people do higher quality of life, and we do know with pain management that if you're stressed out because of severe pain, as you said, the treatments aren't as effective.
Yeah, it wouldn't. You know, I think we still in this country underplay the psychological aspects of health, and in particular physical health. And I could imagine very easily that if someone is more well adjusted to their serious disease, they might eat better, they might sleep better. They may not have thoughts of self-injury as much, ending their own life and so forth, so that life could easily be expected to be higher quality and longer just by addressing that psychological component.
Well, and I think it's important to realize that when you have cancer or any kind of any kind of serious illness, your whole family is kind of going along with you. It's not like you're doing that in isolation. So if palliative care can help support your family and they can see that you're comfortable, everybody does better.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about palliative care, particularly palliative care for cancer in Alaska. My guests are Emily Neenan. She's a government relations director for the American Cancer Society here in Alaska, and Pat Dooley, who is a director of the hospice program at Providence, but is really here to discuss her experience in palliative care pain management. If you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us over the next 40 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You mentioned there are four organizations providing hospice, maybe a fifth shortly. How about palliative care? What are the options there for people?
So in Anchorage, Providence does have a palliative care program. Providence Alaska Medical Center has a wonderful program, and they have expanded out into some outpatient palliative care with the staff that they have, and they're working on. They actually have two fellowships, so they have a physician fellowship for palliative care, and they're working on a nurse practitioner fellowship. So great way to educate more people in our. In our state, hopefully the people that are being educated will stay here and go and found another palliative care program. And then ANMC also has a palliative care program that just started, I think, about a month ago with one of the fellows that graduated from the Providence program.
So who are the components of a typical, let's see, best of class palliative care program?
So it's important. What's very different about palliative care, and it's very similar to hospice, is that everything is patient and family centered. So what are your goals of care and how can we help you? And it's always done in a team, as a team. So it's always interdisciplinary. There's a physician, usually nurse practitioners, nurses, social workers, often a chaplain. And those are the folks that can really help kind of round out all of the care. So the physicians and the nurse practitioners can do the patient, can do pain and symptom management and help with a lot of those pieces. Most people, if you have cancer and you're worrying about paying your bills, suddenly you're not able to do the things that you used to do in your family, or family conflict, the social workers can be invaluable. Keeping the family together as you're rocking along and all these stresses and strains of having somebody in the family that's seriously ill. And then, who did I forget?
How about a psychologist? I didn't hear you mention. Sometimes the social workers are trained in that, and chaplains as well.
Right.
Into the psychosocial aspects, which I want to keep coming back. I think is a tremendously important part of health care in general and health in general.
So the social workers play a key role, and they often can do counseling, and mm-hmm. they're usually licensed clinical social workers or medical social workers, and many of them have a background in counseling, and certainly you could refer out to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or other kinds of things. So a lot of what palliative care can do is actually provide that coordination of care and help people transition in and out of the things that they need.
I'll jump in here. When you're talking about coordination of care, that is really the key component of palliative care, is that team-based approach and being able to coordinate care. There's one other thing I wanted to clarify, too. We talk about some of the medical facilities in Alaska that have palliative care specialty teams officially set up. But that doesn't mean that palliative care isn't happening in a lot of other settings. If you talk to folks, they'll tell you that palliative care was kind of invented by oncologists a number of years ago when they really started to see the needs that their patients were having that were a little different than the standard things they were used to dealing with. So a number of the practices around the state have adopted some of these palliative care components to their practices and to how they work with patients.
Right. And I agree with Emily. More and more, when you talk to an oncology group, they have all of these elements as well, because they really have figured that out.
Well, the whole patient approach is permeating all of medicine. I'm a pediatrician. We've got a a licensed clinical social worker. We've got a care navigator, so forth, is part of a patient-centered medical home. So the same idea is works and is important in almost all aspects of medical care, it seems to me.
It turns out.
It's a great development in our healthcare system.
The coordination of care has been, you know, we all think we have great healthcare in the United States, and there's parts of our healthcare which is outstanding, and there's parts that really don't stand up well. And the coordinated care is one of the things where we've fallen way behind the rest of the world, and it's at least good to see that we're trying to make some efforts to improve that. And by coordinating care, we mean knowing that when you refer somebody, they get to the referral, that the, whoever referred you gets the information back, that they have the ability to get there, they have the ability to pay for the services that are being optioned, or how to navigate all the services that are being offered and so forth. It can be overwhelming. Very quickly, it seems to me.
For the patient family and for the staff trying to help. So it's kind of nice to have a team.
All right. We are close to halfway through the program already, so I have to take my short one-minute break. I want to remind everybody we're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Once again, our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll continue our conversation on palliative care with Emily Neenan and Patricia Dooley. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're discussing palliative care and cancer with Emily Neenan. She is Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society in Alaska, and Pat Dooley. Pat is a hospice program director at Providence Alaska Medical Center, but she's really here addressing the information on palliative care and not necessarily the Providence Palliative Care Program. She wants me to make sure everybody's aware of that. She has a long history of experience in both hospice, palliative care, and pain management. So we're awful glad to have her experience to talk with us today. If you are listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Monday evening, I just want to remind you that's a taped broadcast. We won't be here to answer your questions. You can email questions to us, however, over the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've got experiences with palliative care or pain management or chronic disease and you're wondering if you would be appropriate or the services that might be of benefit to you, this is a good time to call and get those questions answered or those comments made. Locally, our number is 550-8433 and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. One of the things we inevitably have to talk about when we talk about healthcare in Alaska is that we are one immense state, and it's a lot of the population is concentrated in a small area. How well are we getting palliative care opportunities and experiences outside of the major medical center, major population hubs? Let me put it that way.
So I'm glad you asked that. What we're finding, we started a small group called the Palliative Care Alaska Network. A group of about seven of us went to a National Cancer Institute's sponsored workshop in April, learning how to build supportive care programs. But what we actually want to do is see what we can do to help everybody across the state support the people who are doing this. So we actually sent out a survey and to as many healthcare organizations as we could find and think of, and ask them about what they were doing out in their community. And we're hoping to create a small directory, which will help all of us knowing what's out there in small communities, and ask them what they really needed. And they, number one, people were excited to have somebody ask them. Two, people really want education about palliative care. And number three is they really want the conversation about advanced care planning and more coordination across the state on advanced care planning. So we know that people who know, who have given us a real good indication of what they want, helps us give the very best care at the end of, or as they go through their the healthcare system. So we're very excited about that. And what we've found is that there are people out there in almost every community doing something. And as Emily said, and as I said, people are doing palliative care mm-hmm. as best they can in the communities that they're in, often as a team. But it's very hard to do that if you're out somewhere without support. So there's a lot of volunteer hospices in small communities. And I think there's a couple of communities, Seward and Valdez are two that I'm aware of, who would like to start their own volunteer hospices. And volunteer hospices really kind of do palliative care. So what we're trying to do is start the conversation, connect all the dots as best we can, and then hopefully do some education and bring people together, share success. You know, if we have a small community that's really doing a great job, everybody should know about it so that we can share in that.
I had the question down, and I was thinking Emily was going to answer it, which is very, very similar to what I just asked. But let me ask it to you as well, Emily, in maybe a different way, and then see if you bring a different perspective to it. And the question I have written is, what are the current problems in Alaska related to the provision of palliative care to cancer patients? And so you said you're involved in government relations, policy, and so forth. So maybe you see the problems differently.
Yes, so we are looking at the whole system and then what supports need to be in place to increase the availability of these kinds of services to patients. So there's a few ways we go about that. One of them is convening community conversations. We just mm-hmm. convened a forum that was held in Anchorage but webcast around the state and had about 75 people participating in that. It was a great beginning conversation. We identified some issues with getting palliative care sort of out of the population hubs. And by that, I mean the major centers, so Anchorage in particular. One of the things we looked at was Alaska in the tribal health system, so through the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Alaska Native Medical Center, has really been a leader in the nation in looking at telemedicine. So being able to have providers working with patients and their families when they're not in the hospital or not in the doctor's office. So that is a tool that the tribal health system is using now in looking at these things. They are working with patients before they're discharged. If you've got a patient that's in the hospital at Alaska Native Medical Center, for instance, and then they're going back home to somewhere else, the care team will meet with whoever's going to be taking over the care back in say it's a home village. Or even a larger community, but we'll meet with them before the patient's discharged, make sure they understand what to expect, what they're going to need to prepare, and then be able to stay in communication with them when they get home. And that's all great if you're part of that system. If you're not part of that system, then it becomes a lot more challenging to mm-hmm. handle those things around the telemedicine in particular, and that's where there's probably going to be some opportunities for public policy to get involved to make sure that there are sort of the rules, the laws, the regulatory environment is going to be helping patients get that kind of thing.
Pat, you mentioned that kind of one of the ways you approach or the efforts that are made with palliative care is when you first meet with someone is to ask them how well they understand their diagnosis and what is it they want to know. I'm curious from your experience is what is it that are the most common concerns of patients involved in palliative care?
So I think a lot of it is, I think the overwhelming question is, you know, what's going to happen to me? What's next? I think people have concerns about pain, about, I think we all know, you know, we have some wonderful results from chemotherapy and radiation therapy and surgeries for cancer. But I think people want to know, you know, what's the downside? And so, you know, are my feet going to be numb? I'm going to lose my hair. Am I going to have trouble? So a lot of times people are really looking at the symptoms. What can I expect next? And one thing palliative care can do is say, you know, here's what you can expect next, but let's look a little farther down the road as well. You know, have you thought about if this treatment doesn't work, you know, what are you thinking that you'd like to do after that? So I think people are anxious about the outcome, and they're anxious about, you know, what am I going to lose am I going to lose any...
Right.
Anything besides my hair, and am I going to be able to handle what's going on, and what's going to happen to my family, you know, if I can't work, or if I'm not driving the kids to school, or all of those things. So a lot of it is just listening to what people's anxiety is, and we make assumptions sometimes looking at, you know, a gender, looking at an age, and that turns out that that's not their concern at all. So we always have to ask and then really listen for answers.
I want to just let listeners know one more time, you're listening to Line One. We're discussing palliative care for cancer. If you've got questions or comments or experiences to share, our local number 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Can I ask about pain again? I would understand that for at least I would think a large fraction of patients with chronic diseases, particularly cancer, might have concerns about pain. You mentioned pain as one of the concerns. What are the specific concerns that patients have, and what are today's misconceptions about pain that need to be clarified?
Okay, and good questions. I think many people they're worried about being in pain, and I think there's a couple of things there. People worry that if they take pain medication, specifically if they're taking opioids like morphine, they worry that they'll become an addict. And they worry about, if I'm taking morphine now, what will I do when the pain gets really bad? So I think, if I could give anybody a takeaway from here, is that if you're taking an opioid, you know, we can go up on the dose to get that pain managed, and we can manage side effects. And the big side effects for opioids really is constipation, but we can manage that. Mm-hmm. I think people worry about becoming addicted. And I think it's important to understand that addiction is a disease, and it does afflict a small percentage of our population. We believe it's about 10%. But anybody that takes pain medication may become physically dependent on it, but that's not the same as addiction. And if we have time, I'll use my little shoe analogy. Is that okay? Or?
Yeah, I'd love to hear
it. So, I made this up, so hopefully it makes sense to people. But when I say it to people, they seem to understand it. So we live up in Alaska, and we all probably have a closet full of different kinds of shoes. And we're used to wearing shoes. And, of course, we're wearing shoes for a reason. It's because our feet really wouldn't do well out in the cold and in the gravel and all of that kind of thing. So you could say we're physically dependent on those shoes, And but you're not going to wear three pairs of shoes,
When you only need one.
When you only need one, right.
I see your connection.
Right. Yeah. And so if we took your shoes away, you'd go through shoe withdrawal, really.
Yeah.
So what addiction is I've got a fake back on my closet so that my husband doesn't know how many pairs of shoes I have. And I'm picking up strange men in the mall to support my shoe habit.
Right.
So there is a difference there.
Good
so,
point.
So really addiction is when you're taking medication. And I often say if you're taking it for pain as directed, great. If you're taking it to make your life better overall, that's really not what it's designed to do. And so that is a concern. And even people who have addiction problems, we can manage their pain.
Right. All right. We may need to come back to that. There's lots of questions about that. But I think the analogy and the explanation you gave is perfect. I love it. Cynthia, you're on line one.
Hi. I was a nurse for a long time. I'm retired now. But I've noticed that there are a couple of misconceptions about hospice, and I think hospice is absolutely a wonderful thing. But when people don't understand the services, that's why something like this is good. But I had a friend of a friend who needed hospice, and she said, no, she's staying here. We're not putting her in another place.
Right.
And they think of hospice as a place rather than, a service that you can do anywhere. And also that they don't think that they can have their own doctor involved anymore, and that's not true either.
Yeah.
So if you could cover either of those things or both,
yeah,
I would
great.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling, Cynthia. Yeah, I can see very common misconceptions that people might have.
Yes, and thank you, Cynthia, because that's true. Most hospices are community-based, and hospice is a philosophy of care. So it can take place anywhere, and a lot of people think that we're going to put them into like an institution to give them hospice care, but actually we bring the services to your home. Most people on hospice, if you ask them what they want to be home. They don't want to go back to the hospital, and we can do that. So we have a nurse available 24/7. A nurse comes out at least once a week. The social worker comes out. We bring, the aide can come out. And that can be very helpful to people. And so they can stay home, and they don't have to go to the hospital. And we can manage really 99% of the symptoms that you might have at home. You don't need to go to the hospital to have those managed. And, yes, you can, if your physician is willing to cover your care in hospice, then we work with them. But we also have a medical director and other physicians who can be your attending physician. And some physicians actually even choose to just be the attending Monday through Friday during business hours. But we always have a physician available 24/7 for the nurse who's managing your symptoms. So I appreciate you bringing that up. You're right. Those are big misconceptions.
And I think that's an extremely important point. There is generally the movement in healthcare, in medicine, is to try to do as much at home as we possibly can. So there are things that require hospitalization for management, but hospice is a method, as you said. It's a way of approaching the care. But it's not a place, and I can see my mind having slipped into that occasionally thinking as well, so I think it's an important thing to differentiate.
Well, the other piece of that is the 1% of symptoms that we absolutely cannot get managed in at home is if you're agreeable to it, we can actually put you in the hospital, still on hospice, so we work cooperatively with the hospital staff, get your symptoms under control, and then hopefully get you back home again really quickly. So, but most of the time, that we don't even need to suggest that as an option.
Emily, I want to get you back into the conversation, but it may be this is a question more appropriate for Pat as well. But what do you experience in your as the most or the biggest barriers or challenges to getting a palliative care provided to patients who need it? Is it the recognition of the patient, the physician, the system, cost?
Yes.
Communication.
Short answer.
It usually is.
There's a couple things going on. So one is the training for the medical professionals to make sure that they've gotten training in all the different range of things that could be going on with the patient. So that's one piece, and that's why we're working on the federal legislation to increase increase that medical education for physicians and for nurses that are going through school to make sure they have those resources available. Now, that said, we have some systems in place now, not as much as we need. There's more need than we have There's more opportunity, I will say, than we are addressing right now, at least here in Alaska and probably the rest of the country too. We have the other stumbling block is the patients and their family members get scared when they hear palliative care or they hear hospice. And there are some common misperceptions, and I'm just going to put it out there because I've heard it from people as I've been talking about this issue. People say to me, palliative care, does that mean you're going to die? Mm-hmm. And the answer is it actually is not related to that at all, to what your life expectancy is in your disease process. Palliative care
you're
is
actually
about
helping them live longer. It's one of the
better. And better.
Right.
The focus is really better, but the side effect may be longer as
right.
well, which is right. great.
Right.
Another thing you hear, it's interesting to me, but I heard it again just a couple weeks ago, somebody not wanting to take a palliative care referral that was being offered to them because they felt like their spouse, in this case, their wife, who was ill, they felt like that palliative care was going to come in or hospice, either one, and hasten the death, make them die faster somehow. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely not the case. So I just wanted to address those couple things. This isn't about dying. This is about living well during whatever time you have.
Boy, that's disturbing to hear. I mean, I can understand it, how perception versus reality gets messed up somewhat because of a lot of misinformation that must be having its origins out there somewhere to start that kind of thinking. So that's discouraging to hear, but understandable, unfortunately.
I think with hospice, people hear the word hospice and they think that means that it's the last house on the block,
right.
and nobody's going to care for me anymore. And that's not true. It's all about care and comfort.
Yeah, I mean, from a patient standpoint, it also is, though, often associated with end of life care, but not always, and increasingly not so much, it sounds like. And that's the message that we've got to be getting at.
Yeah, and our experience when we talk to families, what we hear is, why didn't they refer us sooner? And I wish I'd gotten this sooner. And then
right.
when people actually don't qualify for hospice anymore because they've gotten better, a lot of times people are really upset.
Well, that just strikes me as we've done parenting classes. I've done all kinds of education about asthma in my 30-plus years up here. And getting people in is the hard part. Once you get them there, they wonder, hey, this is great. So, it's a recurrent theme. It's just it's how do you, so once people see the benefits and not just what they're imagined, their picture of what it may be, it often changes the whole prospect.
There is just one piece of hospice that I would like to mention, and that is we provide a year of bereavement support after a death. And one of the big fears that people have is, you know, who's going to take care of my family? Who's going to help them through the grieving? So hospice does provide that, a whole year of bereavement support after death. There's no charge for it. And we have a lot of community groups for people who are grieving, and they are open to anybody in the community. So, you know, just you can give Providence Hospice a call. We've got groups going all the time. Or you can call one-to-one. And if you actually go on the Providence website and go into hospice, there's some good resources there as well.
I think this is probably the last time I'm going to have time. We got about 5 to 7 minutes left. I want to remind listeners who are listening to us at this time, if they've got questions or comments about palliative care, misconceptions you may have had, issues about pain management, any of the things we've talked about or you might have questions about or experiences with, this is a good time to kind of answer the questions or let others know of your experience. So our local number again, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Another barrier, unfortunately, is often cost, and we really haven't talked about cost. We haven't talked about coverage. Does Medicare, Medicaid, insurance cover it? What are the issues related to cost that and payment that we might want to discuss?
Okay, so palliative care isn't well reimbursed, and hopefully that is something that Emily's going to fix. So I'll leave it up to her.
Right.
Yes, Medicare certified hospice. It's paid for by Medicare, by Medicaid, by private insurance. And certainly Providence cares for anybody regardless of their ability to pay. So the hospice piece is probably the easiest piece. And if you're on Medicare and you qualify, which means that you probably have 6 months or less to live, you're automatically covered by your Medicare benefit.
Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of it. When we talk about the broad scope of palliative care, that's where we can get into some areas where there may be a lot of variation in what insurance, for instance, will cover. So some of the more common things, just having a palliative care doc come do a consult, say when a patient's in the hospital, for instance, that should be covered by insurance without an issue. But the follow-up work, there are more barriers than we would like to see right now. Mm-hmm. Things like making sure that you have access to the kinds of medications that you need, that your palliative care. You may have a palliative care doctor who's prescribing different things and making sure that those are all approved easily and don't just create more barriers for the patient. I think we can kind of get there, but how many of the approvals do you have to go through to get there? We're trying to remove some of those barriers for people that have a serious medical condition.
Another issue that's creeping up is the even people with insurance and even people with Medicare, the deductibles are climbing. We're making a big effort to try to control cost, improve quality, and improve access in this country. And we're not there. I don't know that any country's there. Some are better than others. But I find myself worrying about those deductibles as preventing access to care. One of the ways we control costs is we ask people to have more direct responsibilities. It forces patients and physicians to have more discussion about, do I really need the MRI? What's the advantage of the MRI? How's it going to improve my care? What's it going to do for the quality of my care? And the same question might come up with palliative cares and so forth. How would you answer that question?
Just trying to unpack that. a nest, we'll say, of issues there. We have, obviously, in this country seen some big changes in how insurance is regulated and provided. And yes, certainly as the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, our goal is to get people in to see their providers, because we know that when people have access to care, they're healthier, they stay healthier, as opposed to showing up in the emergency room. Everybody knows right. that if you wait until you've got a really serious condition, that's the most expensive way to deliver care. So in dealing with the deductibles, once you have a diagnosis of a serious medical condition, which is where palliative care comes in, I will say that one of the advantages of a good palliative care system, this team-based approach, is actually dealing with insurance and financial issues with a patient, actually helping walk them through, as opposed to just having them sitting at home with piles of bills coming in and wondering what to do. So that's a piece of it, and that's something that palliative care can actually, when that team-based approach is in place, can be providing.
Yeah. I know I kind of put you on the hot seat there, because it may not be something that comes up, but one idea that would popped in my mind as you were talking about this is maybe, like preventative care visits, palliative care would be a mandatory part of insurance policies, for example, with no deductible. And I'm not espousing mm-hmm. that. I'm not saying anything. I think it has to be looked at in the whole, is it costly, or is it cost-benefit mm-hmm. kind of a service to be offered?
And I know that the insurance companies are looking at this issue, too, and are very interested mm-hmm. in palliative care for the reasons I brought up at the the beginning of the show. When you look at the data on reducing costs mm-hmm. for the patient, for the patient's care, mm-hmm. through having this approach and improving the patient quality of life, the fact that the costs go down is something that the insurance companies are very interested mm-hmm. in. So there's a real opportunity here to have a larger
perhaps to save money, keep people out of the emergency room, out of the mm-hmm. hospital. That overall, it does end up saving money. And as we've already said, quality of life has been shown to be improved mm-hmm. also. So, all right, we're coming to the end of the program. I want to say give you very much my thanks and the Line One crew for taking the time to be with us today and educate us about this. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. We'd be happy to come back anytime.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
If listeners would like to continue the conversation on palliative care and cancer, you can join the KSKA on Facebook for that discussion, and you can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find the link to the Line One archives. And remember, you can listen to this program at any time on those archives, or refer someone that you would like to have listen to that. Also, let us know your thoughts on the same links. Why not join us next Monday, December 14th at 2 p.m., when we will open the phones and emails to your questions about foot and ankle problems with Anchorage podiatrist Dr. Ken Swayman. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer today. I'm sorry, Dave. And I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.